Good afternoon. Today is Friday, June the 26th, 2020. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. One more of my series of podcasts dealing with the life of Americans abroad, which includes expats. It includes those who emigrate permanently from America to take up residence in other countries. And it includes a lot of who I would call accidental Americans. These are people who, well, were accidentally born in the United States, left the United States as young children, moved to other countries where they were citizens of those countries, were educated, married, careers, lived there, and all of a sudden their lives have been greatly disrupted by FATCA and the realization that the United States imposes worldwide taxation on tax residents of other countries, even though they have no economic connection to the United States whatsoever. And today I have a very interesting and special guest, who I will refer to as JR, who has done a lot of work in trying to help the accidental movement to get this obvious injustice remedied. He's been involved in the petition to the U.S. Parliament, and I'd like to introduce him at this point and invite him to, well, introduce himself. So, welcome, JR. Thanks so much for speaking with me today, and looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Hi, John, and thanks for having me on your podcast. By way of kind of quick background information, I am indeed an accidental American. I was, unfortunately, I would say, born on American soil to a French mother and an Irish father. Both of my parents were studying in the US at the time, back in the days when US government was generous with its kind of scholarships and grants. And my parents left the States when I was very, very young, and that kind of severed all my ties with the country until much later in my life, when I had that kind of shock horror moment of receiving a FATCA letter from one of my banks. So that's me, my biographical background, I suppose. And in terms of what I did after that FATCA letter, you know, some people go into hiding. My response to the shock and horror was to come back all guns blazing. And so I tried to find weaknesses in FATCA, in particular because I'm an EU citizen and EU resident, trying to look at kind of legal weaknesses in FATCA. And that's what kind of gave rise to the petition, the European Parliament petition that you mentioned in your introduction.
Well, that's fantastic. Just out of curiosity, do you have any memory of ever having lived in the United States? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I do have some very fleeting kind of childhood memories. So I remember bizarre things like a Jewish grocery at the end of the street I lived on, who used to give me very bitter pickles. And I remember kind of really liking that. So that's probably, and a couple of other things, but, you know, it's really very, very little. And I did go back as a tourist maybe about 6 or 7 years ago, and kind of went back to the place where I was born and grew up, but it didn't really trigger any memories.
Wow, that's totally interesting. And, you know, as children, we have memories of these things being really big. Did it look sort of small to you, or smaller than you imagined it would look?
America looked big to me, because coming from Europe, the cars and everything, the people, the cars, everything is supersized. But this, I didn't really remember much of the surroundings that I grew up in, so I can't really say, unfortunately.
Very interesting. So then basically you grew up in Europe and you're just living your life, and all of a sudden you get a FATCA letter. Have I got that right?
That's correct.
What did the letter say?
Something to the effect of, we've reviewed your file, you have a U.S. indicia, please justify to us your U.S. status, and kind of implying that I was an American citizen, and then all kinds of jargon about, you know, tax compliance that kind of took me a bit by surprise.
Is there any part of you that feels like you're an American citizen?
Not really, in the sense that, without going into huge amounts of detail, my parents divorced while I was in the States, so I was very, very young. It was the l'entente cordiale between the French and more or less English citizen didn't work out. So they divorced when I was very young in the States. And my father went to the UK. my mother stayed on in America, or at least attempted to stay on in America, and she was deported. And so that kind of constructively deported me. So that was, you know, that was a clear signal from the US that I was, or at least from my perspective, not really welcome and not wanted there, because I was constructively deported with my mother when I was an infant. So no, I don't really feel remotely American, to be honest, and culturally and everything else. You know, I'm certainly not culturally American, definitely not. I can't really relate to, I don't have the references.
Well, that's amazing. So you're born in America, but they still found a way to deport you.
Yeah, I suppose not really. You know, technically, I was not deported, but my mother was. So you can't really say to a 3-4-year-old child, you're going to stay without your parents.
Wow. That is some kind of story. Okay. So you get this confusing letter and, you know, I mean, I'm sure you went through the usual. Would that be what we understand when we read the blogs, as sort of an oh my God moment?
Exactly. That is definitely the best way to describe it, an oh my God moment. With that kind of strange realization of, I think, latent in my mind has always been this notion that there might be something out there because of my place of birth. But in that way, sometimes you decide to turn a blind eye to it. I had. And so it was an oh my God moment, but just kind of, it was like opening up the lid on something that I'd always suspected might be there festering away.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And what did you do then? I mean, how does somebody, I guess everybody processes these oh my God moments differently, but how did you process it and what did you do? I mean, at this point, you're an adult, you have your own family. I guess.
Yes. Yes. No, I've got my own kids who are a comparable age to the age I was when I left the state. So, I mean, there's an incredible mix of emotions, to be honest. I mean, it brought up some very strange and unpleasant emotions. My parents divorced when I was young, and I'm not going to dwell on my childhood issues, but this kind of sense of abandonment and neglect from my parents, how could you overlook such an important thing? How could this not have been addressed? So kind of a certain amount of resentment towards my parents, particularly as I had young children at the time, and this notion that I would never allow this to happen to my own progeny. So those kind of emotions, obviously the fear, because it's one of the things that you realize, that I've realized from interacting with the US government, is that it's a scary body. And another accidental who writes very well has written about this online, but the fear of going to a US embassy, they're very hostile environments. There's people with guns, there's barbed wires, there's cameras everywhere. You have to empty your pockets. You go through metal detectors. So that kind of fear factor is amplified by the fact that you're facing the US government. And so that was very present. And it was like, also this notion of my world is just collapsing around me. I'm an international tax evader now. What is going to happen to me? My life is ruined. I'm going to end up in jail. So a slight kind of paranoia and anxiety as well mixed into it. So a whole range of emotions.
But you obviously came through that, and you've done a number of very positive, constructive things. But since we're talking about the oh my God moment, and you know, you're not the first and certainly won't be the last, what advice would you give to somebody who's, first of all, this particular kind of oh my God moment is truly unique, isn't it? Is there any comparable experience to this you've had in your life?
Personally, no. It's probably the worst piece of news that's ever been announced to me so quickly, with the element of shock. So I've never had something quite as intense and unpleasant happen to me, fortunately, before. And kind of how I went about handling it, and I suppose as tangentially, kind of maybe if there are other accidentals out there listening, I mean, I think I went down a pretty well-trodden path, which was I went straight onto the internet and probably spent a couple of sleepless nights just reading voraciously everything I could find, the good materials, the bad materials. I think there was a lot less material in those days, but just voraciously reading things, getting myself very worried the more I read. I then did what I think a lot of people did, and there weren't all the Facebook groups in those days, or there was in Canada, but probably not outside of Canada. I then did what I think a lot of in those days, and hopefully a bit less so now, but I spoke to a lot of US lawyers, whether tax lawyers, whether nationality lawyers, and also US kind of tax preparers, so accountants, all resident overseas, obviously. And that with the benefit of hindsight, with the exception of people like yourself, I regret a little bit because I made some mistakes. I wasted $5,000 on a US tax specialist who assured me that my paperwork was super robust and that he was going to get me a backdated CLN and that it was all a walk in the park. And he was a complete charlatan. His legal work was appalling. And he got me nowhere. He wasted 8 months of my life, I would say, in $5,000, and then spoke to tax preparers who were preparing, estimates of what it would take to get me into compliance with the US tax authorities over 5 years and all the penalties. And it was really scary. So I did that for probably the first 6 months. And I'm not sure it was time or effort well spent.
Yeah. Well, I certainly would agree that one must be very, very careful who one approaches for advice in this type of situation. Fortunately, I think it has evolved somewhat since that time. Just staying on this for a second, because this is very interesting to me. I know that you were sort of a, I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, but I mean, the reality is that you may have been one of the oh my God moment pioneers.
I probably wasn't far from being amongst the first. I think the Canadians were clearly affected before we were in Europe.
Right.
But I probably was one of the first ones to go through this. I wasn't finding many other people on internet talking about it.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. What do you think the difference is between then and now in terms of awareness and, people's consciousness, organization around this issue and that? How is it different? And if so, how?
I think the big difference is probably if you Google accidental American and or FATCA, you'll get a million hits now. And you'll see immediately that there's various Facebook groups in France, in the Netherlands, in the UK, in Canada. So you realize that you're not alone, and we can see it because people join these groups quite regularly with their own oh my God moments, but at least there's a community there to soften the blow immediately and to kind of give them that advice, which is, take your time. Don't be overwhelmed by this. You're not alone. We've all gone through this, and it's not necessarily as bad as it may immediately seem and feel.
Well, you can certainly make it that bad if you do things too quickly. I think that one of the problems with this whole, problem is that, human beings have an emotional need for certainty, especially when they're under stress. And I think you probably would agree with me that there isn't a lot about this that's really, really certain. And what people in the early days, I think, might have done would have said, if I give them all my money, I guess I won't have any left. So that's pretty certain, right? And a lot of people, I think, were very, very, very significantly damaged in the early years. And continue to be significantly damaged. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. But I think that one problem with the oh my God moment is that it's actually an assault on people's identity, because they see themselves as, in many cases, hardworking, honest, law-abiding people. They go out of their way to be tax compliant in France or the UK or Canada or something. And then all of a sudden they're hit with this suggestion that somehow they're not tax compliant. And I think that it's just as upsetting, as much of an assault on their identity as it is on anything else. Do you think that's true?
I would totally agree with that, John. And almost in addition to this notion of, until now, I was a very law-abiding citizen. I prided myself on my clean criminal record and up-to-date tax filings in all the countries where I'm a tax resident or have been. There's also this notion that culturally, somebody's trying to tell me that I'm something that I'm not. I'm not American. I was deported from the country. I look at the States from afar, and there's things I really like, but there's equally a lot of things, and this is way before the current climate where things have become much more toxic. There's always been a lot of aspects of American society that I've inherently disliked and kind of felt very at odds with as a European citizen. And all of a sudden to be told that I'm an American citizen was like, no, you can't force this upon me. That's a choice that I make, you know, and that's based on years of growing up and of cultural affinities. You can't suddenly and unilaterally announce to me that I'm an American citizen. It just does not work that way.
Well, you know, that's very interesting because one of the topics of discussion and debate really for the 10 years that, you know, this has been going on has been, for example, people born outside the United States, the U.S. citizen parents, are they absolutely American citizens or is it a matter of choice? Can the United States forcibly impose citizenship on people not born in the United States? Or is it a law that provides the opportunity but not the obligation to accept it? What are your thoughts, if any, on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously in the camp of it's a choice and should never be transformed into an obligation. You know, I do understand the underlying concerns of having stateless citizens and things of this nature, but I mean, fundamentally, you need to be co-opted to be kind of, you know, it's a two-way equation being a citizen of a country. They have to accept you and you have to feel that, you know, you're part of you're part of that community. And it can't be the case that it's just the community saying you're one of us, whether you like it or not. I don't believe that's the way citizens should work, purely on kind of moral grounds, not on legal grounds, obviously.
Well, I don't, you know, I certainly agree with the moral grounds. I mean, it's never been clear to me, you know, what the legal answer to that question is, because if one looks at, you know, these laws as part of the overall Immigration and Nationality Act, well, the Immigration and Nationality Act is premised on the assumption that every carbon life form on the planet wants nothing more in the world than to first come and live in the United States and or to be a U.S. citizen. That's the only reason for living, is to want to be an American citizen. And if you start with that assumption and you're a legislator and you know, have a statute that says anybody born outside the United States to two American citizens is an American citizen, you know, if you read that in isolation, it seems to proclaim or impose citizenship on the individual. But if you read it in the context of the overall statute, which is really designed to allow individuals the connection to the United States of either citizenship or immigration, I think it's easier to see it as providing an option to formalize U.S. citizenship, but not an obligation to take it. But in any case, it's an interesting topic. Fortunately, people who are born out of the United States, until they start asking the question, are your parents American citizens, probably don't have to deal with that. But it is all very, very interesting on so many different levels. Why do you think the United States has not responded to this situation in any significant way?
I don't really know. I don't really understand America that well, to be honest. And I'm at a bit of a loss as to why these issues seem so sacrosanct. I looking on America from afar, it always seems to me that there's issues that you just can't touch under American politics. And it does seem like, you know, guns is one of those. Religion is almost another one, and the kind of moral dilemmas that come with it. But citizenship seems to be wrapped up in that as well. It almost seems like they're kind of sacrosanct concepts that are enshrined in American laws and that just, you know, can't be touched. Even when society and the times change, they're immutable and you just can't change them. That's my perception of things. But as to why they are that way, I don't know, to be honest, John.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. One suggestion that I think comes from this is that clearly citizenship means different things in different countries. You know, if we compare, for example, Canadian citizenship to American citizenship, they overlap only in terms of the name citizenship. There's something about American citizenship where even for dual citizens, somehow the primary citizenship needs to be American citizenship. And you're part of this collective whole, this sort of psychological manifest destiny where, you know, you are part of the great adventure of asserting Americanness and American values on the rest of the world. It's something like that. But that's a topic for another discussion. Tell me about the petition to the European Parliament.
Yeah, well, look, that kind of followed the oh my God moment. I then had my, let's say, 6 months to 1 year of trying to deal with American attorneys, trying to deal with the US consulate and embassy to do things properly, to do things by the book, because it's always the way of, you know, I'm a law-abiding citizen. But the kind of, I'd say, the sharkish nature of the lawyers I was dealing with and the very intransigent nature of the US authorities, after a year, I just realized, you know, it was like talking to the wall of Wales. I wasn't going to get anywhere with this. And so that's where I decided to, it just seemed so fundamentally and inherently unjust and unfair that it kind of occurred to me that there must be some kind of a legal chink in FATCA's armor. I just could not fathom that, you know, European governments would allow their citizens, albeit tainted with American citizenship, to be subjugated to US laws when they were living and residing and working in European countries. And with that kind of premise, I just set about, rather than spending sleepless nights searching on Google for other accidentals and loopholes and things like that, I just started looking into the laws, you know, reading up a little bit on FATCA a bit more, and then thinking about it a bit more strategically in terms of, right, well, what is really going on here with FATCA, and kind of realizing that, you know, data was becoming a very big issue in Europe at the time. Two things struck me in terms of the legal chinks, let's say. One was just that fundamentally, I did not feel that FATCA sat well with human rights, you know, in Europe and under European legislation. And second was just the data angle, what was going on, these massive transfers of data from the European Union towards the US. That just did not feel right to me, particularly as, you know, everybody was talking about GDPR and these kind of things coming. And it was a little bit before Max Schrems, but there was all these movements of kind of data is important, data needs to be protected, data is a right. Those two things led me to start looking into the quote unquote legality of FATCA. And just reading the European Convention of Human Rights, I stumbled across Article 8, which basically enshrines the right to privacy, the right to a human, to kind of private life, which was the precursor to the GDPR, and several other articles in there that really, when you just read them on their face value, you kind of read this and you think, what's happening to me here? This is incompatible. And so I started looking up the European Court of Justice's case law, and it wasn't really on tax, but when you transposed, you know, tax sharing, or when you transposed into a tax sharing context, all the European Court's decisions clearly, if applied to FATCA, would have invalidated FATCA. And I just thought to myself, I can't believe that I'm discovering this. There must be more to it. So I started reaching out, and by hook and by crook, got put in touch with a number of European politicians and kind of stumbled across Sophie Entveld, the Liberal MEP in the European Parliament, who was a great source of encouragement. She said, you know, do your petition, get this off the ground, I'll back it, I'll help you, kind of thing. So that's really how it came about. It was just that trying to transform something that's very, very negative and very, very frightening into something a little bit more positive. And I could channel all that fear and all those emotions into something that I felt was positive and constructive. And I think for me, it was quite cathartic, actually, the petition.
Well, I want to say that I saw the videos of you at those, and I think you did a masterful job. You were absolutely incredible. And I think that all people who are concerned about this issue owe you a great debt. So congratulations and thank you for that. Could you, though, structurally, can you just kind of, for the benefit of listeners, take me through how the petition process worked and exactly what was the question you were asking them to deal with and all of this sort of stuff?
Yeah, so the process to launch a European Parliament petition is pretty flexible. You just have to have an idea, really. There's no prescribed format for submitting a petition, but there obviously has to be a subject matter of European interest. And so, you know, I've looked at a lot of the petitions that were surrounding me as I've kind of presented on various occasions in Brussels, and it ranges from things around, you know, bullfighting rights to the journalist that was effectively politically assassinated in the island in the Mediterranean. Anyway, the name escapes me. But yeah, there's a real random host of issues, but there's no real prescribed format. So what I just ended up doing was, I suppose, for want of a better term, a bit of a legal brief as regards the application of FATCA and its kind of incompatibility with the European Convention of Human Rights, and in particular Articles 8, I think it's 12 and 14 were the ones I homed in on, and just a commentary of those articles, you know, and the case law that surrounds them, and kind of why, you know, FATCA just did not work. Just FATCA was an infringement of my human rights under the European Convention of Human Rights. And I ended up with a 30-page document that I had a couple of friends read and help me edit. And I just punted that out. And it got a lot of traction quite quickly. There was a lot of interest in it from the, obviously outside of the formal process. I sent it to Sophie Enveld. And she seemed very keen on it. She really bought into it immediately.
And what are Articles 8, 12, and 14? In a very general sense.
Yes, I should remember these now, but 8 is the main one. 8 is really the right to privacy, the right to a private life, and that requires all things that have been reprised in a slightly different guise under GDPR, but intrusions, infringements of this right to privacy should remain exceptional, and any infringement must be proportional. All these notions, and those were the things that really the case law was developed on, and that really sat badly with FATCA, and that, you know, sit badly with GDPR as well. It was really those, all the themes that we're still seeing kind of churned up in Europe. Article 12, it's terrible. It's been such a while now.
Article 8 provides the sort of it's the philosophical genesis and underpinning of the GDPR, right?
That's the way I see it. I don't know if the legislators see it that way, but that's the way I see it. It's definitely the embryo of GDPR.
Right. Interesting. Okay. So this has been going on now for some years, since I believe it started in 2016, right?
Yeah, I officially filed the petition in 2016, but obviously I'd been working on it since late 2015.
Sure. So you filed the petition, and what's the process been? I know there was the initial hearing, and then there was, just curious what how it works, how it's rolled out. I believe it's still alive. You had what, two or three hearings, didn't you, over that period?
Yeah, so it's a slightly unstructured process, and I think it really depends on the petition and how, quote, unquote, well the petition does. An initial filtering of the petition where they throw out the ones that don't have relevance to the European Union. The petition has to have some relevance to European laws or the functioning of European bodies. And clearly this one did, because we were saying that the European Convention of Human Rights was breached and that, you know, the European authorities were turning a blind eye to it. That was the kind of the conclusion of the petition. So I was told quite quickly, you know, you'll make it through that preliminary filtering. A fair amount of political interest from the European Liberals, so the ALDE party in those days, who were in contact with me quite a bit about it and kind of helping me navigate the meanders and the corridors of Brussels. But it quickly led to a first audition, which I think it's a slow process. These things are slow, and I'm realizing how bureaucratic and how slow things are in Brussels. But it led to a first audition, which I think was in the summer of 2017, so almost a year later. And that's the video that you were referring to earlier, John, which is on YouTube. And, you know, the commission came up. I'd had, in parallel to the petition, there were various discussions I was having with the commission and other bodies, meeting high-ranking civil servants in the European Commission, but they were all going nowhere. They didn't really want to talk to me. There was the audition, which I'm not quite sure what the purpose was, other than just to bring the matter to the to the attention of the world in a public hearing. Shortly after that, there was the resolution that was voted in the European Parliament, or shortly after, kind of 6 months after that, there was that resolution that was tabled by, and this was what was interesting, it was starting to gain political traction. So it wasn't only the Liberals who were looking at it, but and Virginie Rozière, who is a socialist MEP, really picked up the baton as well. And the ALD and the socialists managed to get this resolution tabled. The resolution was, it was a plebiscite. It was, you know, I think only 40 MEPs out of whatever the 600 that were present, and they were all kind of fringe weirdos, voted in favor of our petitions. You know, it was a non-binding resolution, but it exhorted the Commission and the Council of Ministers to basically take the issue seriously. As usual, the Commission, all European executive bodies just took no notice of that resolution. And so off the back of that, there were kind of like little informal non-public hearings in Brussels that I attended in the meantime. The Petty Commission then commissioned a report from Professor Garbarino, because GDPR had come out by this stage, and Garbarino's report, you know, highlighted manifest breaches of GDPR as a result of FATCA. Again, the Commission ignored that. So to try and get traction again, a further public hearing was organized in early 2019, so about a year ago, which is also on YouTube. And that was a much longer hearing. This was a three-hour event where they invited French politicians who'd been pushing back on a domestic front. They had a representative of the Dutch government, because the Dutch have been very involved at an individual level, but as a governmental level as well. And representatives of the European Banking Federation, myself, Fabien Le Hagre was there. And again, unfortunately, there was a press conference afterwards that wasn't particularly well attended. That didn't kind of whip up the frenzy that we were hoping. I think the view of the European politicians that are supporting us, that they're hoping that these political events will help the media get interest in the matter. And if the media get hold of it, then maybe the European Commission will actually get off its hands and start to do something about it. But unfortunately, again, that hasn't happened the desired effect. So the petition as of today is still open. I'm told informally by people in Brussels that run the petition process that they have no intention of closing it, because it's a thorn in the Commission's side. You know, they can stonewall us, but they can't make this thing go away. And so I'm told it's the longest standing petition in the European Parliament, but we don't really know at this stage where it's going. And if I'm brutally honest and blunt, it's probably, you know, it's not going to get the Commission to listen to us. It's not my petition that's going to kind of crack that nut.
What are your thoughts on the UK initiative from Jenny? It seems to be aligned with yours in the sense that, you know, both of you are arguing, we're arguing based on privacy principles.
Yes, we're very much aligned from a kind of, I'd say, almost the points that are being argued in Jenny's suit are totally aligned with the petition, because I took proportionality was one of the main limbs of my petition, and that's the crux of their argumentation as well. I'd say that's really important as well, because I think some of the other lawsuits that we've had in Europe, in particular the French claim in front of the Conseil d'Etat, it was a great idea and it was a really good argument and a really good case, but they were really focusing on the lack of reciprocity under the IGA between France and the States. And that was a pretty easy one for the French authorities just to kind of swat away. You know, proportionality wasn't even raised in the French, it wasn't properly argued in the French case. And that unfortunately is coming back to haunt us a little bit today, because we could see in the letter that Jenny got back from the data privacy watchdog in the UK, they referred to the French case and they said, oh, well, the French authorities have said FATCA's fine from a French law perspective, therefore we're going to ride on this. So unfortunately, it's become a little bit of a hindrance for Jenny's case. But yeah, we're spiritually very, very much aligned with Jenny's case. And I personally believe that Jenny's case is the way forwards for us in Europe, for the simple reason that, as I mentioned earlier, I think the petition will never get the Commission to the petition will never get the media interest that it deserves, because the subject matter is too complex for journalists to cover. Yeah. And as a result, we won't get the Commission's interest off the back of the petition. Therefore, the only way to do it is via the judiciary and get impartial judges to look at it.
Right. Well, that's certainly been the experience in Canada as well, where you know, we've been carrying this this lawsuit since really 2014. And, you know, here it's being argued based on violations of the Canada Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So it's quite interesting. And, of course, there was the earlier lawsuit in the United States brought by Jim Bob, Solomon Yu, and I guess it was Republicans overseas. All of these have had slightly different twists, which kind of shows you how many problems there are with FATCA, right, and with the IGAs. But, you know, I think the biggest problem, we talk about these initiatives led by you, led by Jenny, led by the people in Canada, led by Republicans overseas, led by Fabian's Accidental Americans group. But there just doesn't seem to be a ton of public support. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. And, you know, from the Facebook pages, you can see the political kind of divergences are sometimes very pronounced. But from a European perspective, I would agree with that. There's a lot of us to start off with. I mean, we should be much more organized than we are. And what was interesting, even when we were doing our due diligence in the European Parliament and looking at the various MEPs and petitioning them to make sure that they would vote in favor of the resolution, we unearthed at least two either dual citizens or accidental European MEPs. And that was interesting to me because there's some very high-ranking people with a lot of power who are necessarily affected by all this. But I think the problem we have, at least in Europe, is that we have pockets of people who want to do things. We've seen a couple of people who showed promise in Italy. The guys in Holland are great. They're really active and really dynamic. There's not a huge number of them, but they're pretty good. Jenny's been instrumental in the States, and Fabien has done a phenomenal job in France. But the problem is that I suppose each one of those groups really works a little bit in isolation, and I suppose it's maybe the European patchwork that it's fault here, but there's not a huge amount of collaboration between those different groups, and it's hard to collaborate because people have different agendas and different ways of working. And so that's one obstacle I think that we face, a little bit of not being able to federate all those actions, which is one of the reasons why I'm so keen to work with Jenny to show people that this is the way that we're going to get things done. And it's by kind of, and I have opened up my petition to Jenny. So I've said to Jenny and to her law firm, Michon Dorea, you can argue your GDPR point inside of my petition. And I'm just going to give you the platform to do that. You know, I stand to one side and you do it, because it's not about me, it's about the cause. But I think that's one issue. And then the second issue is just the accidentals themselves. I think a lot of them need to have a hard look at themselves in the mirror. And so kind of they're just not up to the task. I mean, people are indignant. They come onto Facebook groups expecting help, expecting people to wave it away with a magic wand. But when we actually ask them to contribute, either financially or in time or in effort, with the exception of Fabien's team that have been very good and have invested a lot of time and a lot of effort into things, most other people just kind of walk away and do nothing and neither contribute, don't want to help. You know, that's kind of disappointing to me, because our strength will always be in numbers, but we haven't got the numbers right now because we're too fissiparious as a group, and we lack kind of, I don't know, enough people with enough drive and enough sense of an indignation to do something about it. We need more Jennies, I suppose.
Well, we need more of you. We need more of, you know, it is a very small number of people who've been working on this problem, and there should be a lot more. But, you know, working on this is one thing, but what I find astounding is, you know, the small number of people who signed your petition, the small number of actual contributors to Jenny's law. Like, how is this even possible that these numbers can be so low?
And we can always find excuses, John. So like the petition protest, and again, Fabien, when he gets his army of accidentals into gear, they're very effective. So for the petition, one of the explanations could be just that the process to support the petition is extremely fiddly. The webpage is very unuser-friendly, and it's very actually hard to understand how to support the petition. But at the time the resolution was going through the European Parliament, Fabien got his kind of his team together and wrote out to everybody to get everybody and their families and relatives to support the petition. And so, you know, there was a real concerted effort to do it. So I think the petition might just be over the fiddly nature of the platform, but probably not, is the honest answer. In terms of Jenny's lawsuit, I just don't know if people kind of go into hiding and think, right, They're never going to come and get me. This is never going to impact me. I'm just going to turn a blind eye to this and not back the cause and try and forget about it. And maybe in some respects, funding it, being involved in it kind of prevents them from kind of forgetting about it and completely turning a blind eye to it. It's the only explanation I can find. I mean, I can't understand why people wouldn't put money into the cause otherwise.
You would agree that it would, you know, by supporting it would elevate the importance of this in the public domain. I mean, it's almost like sending a message saying, well, you know, this isn't important, right?
I think you're spot on, John. I think everybody, it's human nature. Everybody, whenever something comes up, people go onto Google these days and type it into Google, and then they look at what comes up. And when you look at Jenny's funding page or my petition, and the authorities, and we know the Inland Revenue in the UK was looking at it. I know that the European Commission was looking at it. I know that the French CNIL and the European Data Privacy Board, that they've looked at these things just to see the number of backers. And when they see that we can't raise more than £100,000 or that I can't get more than 1,000 petitioners, yeah, as you say, they know that this is not something to be on their list of issues that keeps them up at night. This is not going to be one of them because it hasn't reached critical mass.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I'm part of the group running the anti-FATCA lawsuit in Canada. And, you know, to your point about governments looking at the web pages, a part of the material that the government organized as part of their submissions of material were actually excerpts from things that I had written, blog posts, and stuff like that. I mean, I'm not sure what they thought they were trying to do with the stuff, but it was interesting that showed up in their materials. But, you know, on the issue of public support, you're aware of the Harry Dunn brouhaha in the UK, are you?
Sorry, say that again, John.
Are you aware of the group that's supporting the Harry Dunn family in the UK? You know, this.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I actually did a podcast with Rad Seeger, who's, you know, been organizing that, has done an absolutely phenomenal job and continues to do a phenomenal job. But what I find interesting is that one thing he's been able to do is generate a lot of public support. Now, maybe that's just because this is just such an obvious no-brainer. Maybe it's because to support it doesn't mean that, you know, it's an announcement to the IRS that you're out there or something like that. But the fact of the large amount of public support has been very, very much a weighty factor, I think, in putting pressure on the UK government to deal with this, right?
For sure. I think they can be slightly differentiated, though, and unfortunately for us, in the sense that I always look at kind of accidental Americanism as being a bit of a congenital disease that you're born with, and it's a rare disease. It's an orphan disease that is very complicated and only certain brain or kind of medical experts understand properly. And so it's hard to relate to for the outside world. People just get a bit lost. What is it? Is it a citizenship issue? Is it a tax issue? What is it you're talking about and what do you want? And actually, is it really that bad because you've got an American passport? And so they struggle to relate to it in the same way that maybe they do with the Dunn case, which is a clear kind of, you know, it's very easy to relate to. It's very easy to explain. And it's therefore very easy to whip people up into a frenzy over. I think we struggle with the subject matter a little bit. And I don't think we found a way of kind of turning it into this, you know, this cause that people would feel an immediate sense of indignation over. We've tried lots of different angles, you know, the kind of slightly anti-Americanism in France is normally fertile territory, but it hasn't really taken off the way I thought it might. So I think that could be the issue here.
So the key is to incite accidental American hysteria.
I don't think so. I've always thought that the key is actually getting European banks involved. That's always been slightly my tactic, which is individual citizens in Europe are not going to make things change. However, European governments will listen to European banks. And right. So if we can cause a chink in the FATCA armor and force the banks to wake up to the issue, then we stand a chance. But without a credible lawsuit that really damages FATCA and puts banks in a very awkward position, we can't get there. Because for now, they're FATCA compliant. They want nothing to do with it. It's fine. FATCA is no longer an issue for them.
Yeah, I think that you're right on that. Okay, you know, I really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with me today. This has been great. I wonder if maybe, as kind of closing here, what about a pitch for why this matters and why people really need to support these initiatives?
I mean, it seems so axiomatic. If you are affected by it, then you must support it, because if you don't, nothing's ever going to change. So you can't just pretend this is not an issue for you, because it will come back. Eventually, your bank will be writing to you. You will get that letter, and maybe it won't be you, but maybe it will be your estate. So, you know, you're just passing on an issue to your next of kin. So for me, that's the obvious reason. And if you are affected by it, then in the way I have and lots of other people have, then, you know, mobilize people in your immediate surroundings. I know that my family members have all shared my petition and shared my kind of clips of my intervention at the European Parliament widely and raised awareness and whipped up, you know, not frenzy, but whipped up indignation at the situation and the kind of Kafkaesque position we find ourselves in. And if everybody had contacted at least 5-10 people in their immediate vicinity, if everybody affected was doing something and contacting 10 people, you know, we'd be talking hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Europeans saying this is an issue, we need to do something about it. But yeah, that may or may not happen. So I think second best to that is funding Jenny's lawsuit, because I really genuinely believe that the English judges in particular, more so than continental judges in Europe, if UK judges get the issue, they will find the right answer. They will look at this objectively. And if we get that, if there is that chink, then we have a very good chance to do something.
What do you think about the approach of these people that, you know, their basically approach is just avoid compliance and the whole thing will go away? I take it you would not. You don't buy into that.
The kind of not going into compliance, that's, you know, a very personal decision. I think everybody needs to look at it on their own facts. But in most cases, it would seem to me that that would be the right decision, absent some family or economic tie to the States or some desire to go back to the States in the future. Sorry, can you repeat the question, John? I lost myself a little bit.
Yeah. You know, I think that there's a certain school of thought out there. I mean, I'm thinking again of the small amount of public support for the initiatives that you're involved in, and Jenny, and we in Canada. And a lot of what you see in blogs, Facebook groups is, well, just don't comply. That's all you have to do is not comply.
Yeah.
Is that helpful to the general cause of striking this stuff down and getting these laws changed?
Yeah, so most certainly not. Sorry. So the decision whether to comply or not needs to be made on personal grounds. That's just what I was trying to mark down. In terms of then what you do next, whether you decide to comply or not, I mean, to me, it's the wrong attitude to do nothing. People need to speak up. People need to fight back. People need to fund. You know, there's lots of different ways people can get involved in this fight. For people that don't have the time or the bandwidth,
whether they comply or not, right?
Yeah.
And
to a certain extent, maybe the people that do comply could become better spokespeople, because it's much easier for them to speak out. They're in compliance. They have nothing to fear from the IRS. They should be speaking out in a much more vocal manner, I'd have almost felt.
Well, they're just as afraid as the ones who don't comply. I mean, there's two kinds of people terrified of the U.S. government. Those who file taxes and those who don't file taxes. And it seems to me that that's part of the problem. But at the end of the day, I think that part of the challenge here is to get people to understand that this is a problem that is far, far greater than the issues affecting any one individual. And it's hard to get people, I think, to focus, you know, beyond their own immediate interests sometimes.
For sure. And that's actually where I think Filippo's work. So Filippo is the Filippo Nocella, the partner of Michon de Rea, who's running Jenny's lawsuit. One of the things that I think he's doing, which may help in this regard, which I think is very good just cosmetically, is that he's publishing all his correspondence, every legal brief he writes, every letter he writes, every letter he receives, he publishes it on the Michon de Rea webpage. And that I think is brilliant. In a fight against a law that's supposed to be transparent, he's being completely transparent when obviously and quite clearly to us, the European authorities are being very opaque and untransparent over how FATCA was enacted, over their real views in terms of GDPR compatibility. And that, I think, is really interesting because that highlights it, and that may just garner a little bit of interest from other people who may think, and that may kind of, you know, help people to coalesce a little bit in this notion of there is a cause here, there's a definite right, a wrong to be righted. And so maybe that transparent approach that Filippo's adopting will be useful in the long run.
Well, I think that's interesting, and I think that is a great thing for him to do. And I think it's, you know, a tribute not only to his skills as a lawyer, but as his skills as a strategic thinker. So there's a lot of great stuff going on, and including absolutely, your tremendous efforts. And I want to thank you very much for spending the time to chat with me today, and perhaps we can do this again down the road. Do you have any final messages you'd like to send out to listeners on this?
Well, no, just to thank you for your time, John, to thank you for having me on the show, and to kind of wish all our cousins, whether they're kind of US expats, accidentals, all the best in their various endeavors, and in particular to the Canadian community that I know you're very close to, because they really were the pioneers and they showed us the way. So to thank them, I suppose. And yes, you've been kind of making the point, encouraging people who may just be sitting on the touchline to get involved. There's so many things and so many ways to get involved.
Well, that's fantastic. And in closing off, I have been having a fascinating discussion with JR, who is the architect of the EU anti-FATCA position, a petition, which is still open. So thank you very much.
Thanks, John.